Thank you, Victor, for the kind introduction and to RJ for the invitation to speak today on the topic of religion and free markets. It's a pleasure to be on a panel with Rusty Reno, whose magazine sent me an email this morning reminding me to renew my subscription. Take care of that right after this. So I'd like to start my comments today by recalling an event that happened 51 years ago at a meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, an organization founded by F.A. Hayek in 1947 to rescue classical liberalism from the political and economic margins to which it had been consigned. At the 1972 MPS meeting, Irving Kristol, author of, among other things, Two Cheers for Capitalism, was invited by Milton Friedman to address the Mont Pelerin Society. Kristol's six pages of remarks were entitled Socialism, Capitalism, Nihilism. I have been informed by two people who knew him, however, that Kristol initially considered striding to the podium and saying seven words: man does not live by bread alone, and then departing the stage. Now, Kristol himself, at that point of his life, was a somewhat secular-minded Jew who was in the process of rediscovering the ancient faith of his forebears. He was very much convinced at this stage of the case for free markets and the superiority of capitalism as an economic system that far outpaced all the alternatives in terms of creating wealth and reducing poverty. But his comment about God and mammon reflected two other realities. One was his concern that the self, that is, quote, he said, realized under the conditions of liberal capitalism, turns out to be a self that despises liberal capitalism and uses its liberty to subvert and abolish a free society. So, to paraphrase Kristol, free marketers can easily refute Marxist economics, but capitalists, qua capitalists, have nothing to say when confronted by Friedrich Nietzsche and his disciples on the left and the right. The market itself was insufficient for generating the norms that free societies require if they are to survive. Now, that was clearly a critique of Friedman, who Kristol believed was simply inattentive to the need for extra economic bulwarks for free societies and free economies, among which religion, or at least specific types of religion, seemed to Kristol's mind to be indispensable. Now, the second concern to which Kristol's observations gave rise was the reality that the topic of religion and free markets has been fiercely contested virtually from the moment that modern capitalist economies emerged in the 19th century. These debates acquired particular traction following the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of critiques of capitalism from socialists and Marxists, but also traditionalist sources, often shaped by strong religious convictions. Some such critiques have involved outright rejection of capitalism in favor of something like Christian socialism or guild socialism, or in the 20th century, corporatism on the right and liberation theology on the left. In these instances, such rejections of capitalism generally reflected a more general rejection of modernity and/or the embrace of utopianism associated with attempts to immanentize the eschaton. Other religious critics of capitalism were more at ease with basic institutions associated with markets, private property, competition, free prices, etc. But they also articulated specific criticisms of free markets. Typically, these concerned particular outcomes in the realm of distribution, or the market's perceived effects on particular social groups, or what were regarded as negative cultural effects associated with market competition and wealth creation. The remedies to these apparent shortfalls of markets were also, invariably, some form of government intervention, sometimes in the form of specific regulations or wealth distributions, Or, in other cases, they might have amounted to specific limitations on economic activity, such as restricting commerce on the Sabbath, or severe limitation, if not prohibition, of certain activities on grounds of their intrinsic immorality or negative social consequences. In the same period, another way of thinking about religion and markets emerged. This might be called the Weberian approach. Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism famously argued that capitalism was more than just the production and exchange of goods in particular ways within particular institutional settings. At its heart, Weber argued, capitalism was essentially a state of mind. It was about rationality and subordination of emotion, custom, tradition, folklore, and myth to the workings of instrumental reason. Weber maintained that this linkage of rationality with economic practices occurred primarily in those areas of Europe containing significant numbers of ascetically inclined Protestants. He had in mind countries like England and the Netherlands, which developed powerful commercial orientations. By inculcating a belief among its adherents that they needed to avoid superficial pursuits and to commit themselves totally to whatever calling God had summoned them, Puritan forms of Calvinism, Weber theorized, played a major role in capitalism's emergence. Now, there are many well-founded and I think even decisive objections to Weber's specific analysis and claims. These range from his inaccurate grasp of the theology of the versions of Puritan capitalism that he had in mind to empirical facts. The most important being that, as Joseph Schumpeter noted in his History of Economic Analysis, all the basic practices, protocols, and institutions associated with capitalism were well in place in Europe and operating smoothly as early as the 12th century. Long ago, the economic historian Randall Collins illustrated that, quote, the institutional preconditions for capitalism fell into place for the first time in the High Middle Ages. And not only the institutional preconditions, but a version of the developed characteristics of capitalism can also be found then, end quote. That same Middle Ages was also characterized for the most part by diffuse and decentralized forms of political arrangements. Harold Berman and others long ago showed us that monarchical absolutism and the modern centralized state is far more characteristic of modernity than the Middle Ages. Just one of those truths that doesn't fit the integralists' ahistorical view of the world. But for all the serious problems with Weber's thesis, Weber did identify something important, which is the role played by particular beliefs associated with specific religions, most notably Judaism and Christianity, in driving capitalism's emergence, while simultaneously identifying principled limits on the scope of markets. One insightful thinker on this subject was the former chief rabbi of Great Britain and the Commonwealth, the late Jonathan Sacks. In 1998, Lord Sacks was invited to deliver the Institute for Economic Affairs annual Hayek Lecture. Entitled Markets and Morals, Sacks' lecture repays careful reading, not least because it reflects the sensibility of a man of deep faith who nonetheless took free markets seriously. His lecture considered carefully the role played by core Jewish tenets in opening up the way for capitalism. While freely acknowledging that many contemporary Jewish movements have advocated socialism, Sacks stated that it was possible to identify what he called an elective affinity between Judaism and the market economy. Among these affinities he listed, first, the biblical respect for property rights. Sacks describes this as nothing less than a revolution against the ancient world and the power it gave rulers to regard the property of the tribe or their people as their own property. Second, Sacks noted Judaism's positive attitude to work and wealth creation. The story of man's creation begins with the command, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it." God deliberately left the world unfinished so that it could be completed by the work of man. This view is not to be found in pagan thought. A third tenet identified by Sacks was another revolution of biblical thought. that it demythologized nature. For the first time, humans could see the condition of the world not as something given, sacrosanct and wrapped in mystery, but as something that could be rationally understood and improved upon. That in turn implied an openness to innovation. Of course, the pagan peoples also invented things, but they didn't bestow divine light significance upon innovation. Fourth, Sachs pointed out that Judaism effectively invented the notion of linear time. Pagan cultures tended to think of time as cyclical, as seasonal, a matter of eternal recurrences that reflected an unoriginal and unchanging nature of things. The Hebrew prophets were the first to see time in a quite different way, as a journey towards a destination, a narrative with a beginning, middle, and eventually an end. It was ultimately to this revolution that we owe the very idea of progress as a historical category, the idea that things are not predestined to remain what they were, that hope, even more than necessity, is the mother of invention. Now, these basic tenets, I'd suggest, were universalized, more or less, by Christianity. Now, as Sachs himself noted, it would be quite wrong to identify a great religious tradition with any particular set of economic institutions. That said, I'd suggest that all four elective affinities identified by Sachs are essential to any economy with capitalist characteristics. Frankly, it's difficult to identify where else these basic preconditions for markets may have arisen. Think of it this way. An economy in which nature is worshipped as a god, in which property rights are limited if not non-existent, in which the creation of wealth doesn't occur or is viewed with suspicion, or where poverty is viewed as the natural state of affairs rather than something to be overcome, is not an environment in which free markets can exist, let alone flourish. Now, some might say, well, this is all well and good, and maybe even true. But, they might add, isn't this really beside the point? Isn't it the responsibility of religions like Judaism and Christianity, which have particular expectations about the demands of justice, to identify where markets don't meet the demands of justice, commutative justice, distributive justice, or legal justice, and to propose remedies? Rabbi Sachs certainly believed that this was the case. Judaism, he stressed, insisted that there were right and wrong ways of acting, including in the marketplace. Much Jewish law, he pointed out, dealt with things like honesty in exchange, what made a contract just, and emphasized that your responsibilities for your neighbor went beyond the do-no-harm principle, that you're expected to be charitable, to help those in need, to care for those who are incapable of caring for themselves. Such things may or may not be economically efficient, but they are concrete demands that one was expected to fulfill and which responded to particular needs that markets, qua markets, could not address. At the same time, Judaism and Christianity's attention to the Sabbath exemplified that there were spaces that economic activity was not supposed to go. As Sachs wrote, quote, "What marked the Sabbath off from all other religious celebrations in the ancient world was its concept of a day of rest. So unintelligible was this to the writers of ancient Greece that they accused Jews of observing it merely out of laziness." But what was at the heart of the Sabbath was and is the idea that there are important truths about the human condition that cannot be accounted for in terms of work or possession and consumption of material goods. So here we see two ways in which religion can shape free markets. The first is to remind us that economic freedom does not absolve us from the responsibility to be just in our dealings with others. The second is to remind us that there is more to life than the world of supply and demand, and that when we lose ourselves in that world, we lose an essential understanding of who we fully are as persons. Now, to the extent that religion performs these functions in today's capitalist economies, I'd suggest that most religious communities do so inadequately and in many cases very badly. For much of the 20th century, for example, different churches tended to think about capitalism as a macroeconomic phenomenon. Far less attention was paid to the microeconomic dimension, that of justice in exchange, the responsibilities associated with property, the content of contracts, the functions of money, etc. The types of topics that were studied by 16th and 17th century Dominican and Jesuit scholastics that made tremendous contributions to our contemporary understanding of these things. And when it came to perceived flaws with capitalism, the answer expressed in formal church documents was invariably the same. The government needed to intervene, whether by regulation or redistribution. In some cases, religious communities proposed systematically reorganizing capitalism wholesale with something like the corporatist system outlined in the 1931 papal encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. In making these recommendations, most such texts gave at most lip service to the limits of what the state could do, were reluctant to concede the well-known side effects often associated with state intervention, or appeared frankly indifferent to what economics tells us about these very real limits and very predictable negative effects. Yes, there were exceptions to this general picture, but that's the point. They were notable for being exceptions. Far more common were documents like the United States Catholic Bishops Conference 1986 document, Economic Justice for All, which, apart from its strong pro-life emphasis, was basically indistinguishable from the Democratic Party's platform. Or more recently, the papal encyclical Laudato Si reflected a frankly cartoon-like view of market economies, made sweeping and easily rebuttable claims about the workings of markets, reflected all the well-established errors of the much-discredited dependency theory in its analysis of the global economy, gave the distinct impression that its authors wished that the Industrial Revolution had never happened, and didn't even get around to mentioning the name of the Lord Jesus Christ until its 82nd paragraph. Now, in more recent times, much of this call for ever-widening intervention has been made in the name of the common good. But whether it comes from left-leaning modernist Protestants or right-leaning Orthodox Catholics, the common good generally functions here as a lexicon for government intervention of various types. What's puzzling about this is that it's actually contrary to the long tradition first expressed in the writings of Thomas Aquinas and elaborated upon by contemporary natural law theorists like John Finnis, which understand the political common good as doing three things. First, identifying the responsibilities of the state while simultaneously putting principled limits around what the state may do. Second, reminding us of the concrete and antecedent responsibilities of families and intermediate associations when it comes to addressing social and economic problems. And third, that flourishing and the life of virtue depends radically on people making the free choice for such things themselves and the space in which to do so. So where do we go from here concerning the relationship between religion and free markets? Let's assume for the moment that the basics of capitalism are here to stay. Let's also assume that religion properly understood is essentially about our beliefs and convictions concerning the truth about the transcendent. Many of those convictions have direct implications for our free choices in the here and now. Yet those same beliefs also tell us that attempts to realize heaven on earth results in terrible things. If those two assumptions hold, I would make two suggestions. First, religious institutions, qua religious institutions, should generally refrain from making pronouncements about the details of economic policy questions, wage levels, the size of welfare programs, etc. That does not, of course, stop religious believers from commenting as citizens, qua citizens, or technical experts, qua technical experts, on the details of such policies. But they should do so primarily on the basis of reason, philosophy, and sound social science. Yes, there may be gross injustices which religious leaders have a responsibility to speak against, but those occasions are, I'd suggest, relatively few. For the most part, the responsibility of religious leaders is to articulate moral principles and form consciences. It is not their responsibility, qua religious leaders, to enter economic debates that are, for the most part, topics for prudential judgments for religious believers, or what Aquinas called determinatio. Second, synagogues, churches, temples, mosques, etc., in capitalist economies have a responsibility to remind people, believer and non-believer alike, that there are realms in which the logic of supply and demand does not and should not apply, that ultimate meaning is not to be found in the consumption for the sake of consumption or possession for the sake of possession, that it is not wrong to have things, but it is wrong when the great growth of wealth generated by capitalism becomes the primary lens through which we understand ourselves and our world, that there is the realm of the sacred and the holy, which conveys eternal truths about us and the world, some of which are not immediately accessible via reason and which cannot be expressed in the language of market exchange. In sum, perhaps the greatest good that religion can realize in capitalist economies proceeds from the very fact that religion transcends politics, economics, and market exchange. Religion, properly understood, opens our horizons to those goods: beauty, reason, truth, love, marriage, family, creation, that ultimately point to the Creator, something which ought to induce humility in us, inhibit us from thinking of ourselves as gods, and help us to understand our economic activities in light of these ultimate realities. There is no shortage of economic commentary out there, but there is a major shortage of sophisticated religious minds like a Rabbi Sacks or like a Joseph Ratzinger, who show us how to wrestle with the new things of capitalism in a way that's respectful of sound social science and economic theory, but which also bring to bear the wisdom of those ancient, unchanging truths revealed by the Logos himself. For therein lies the true transformative of power of religion upon our civilization, that religious believers would, I submit, be foolish to ignore in favor of becoming just another secular NGO that has nothing to say that cannot already be said by just another secular NGO. Thank you.